Are you ready to learn how to grow your interior design business? Welcome to the lounge, the Chase Lounge. So get comfortable, grab a glass of Cabernet, and let's talk the business of interior design. Now, here's your host, Nick May.
Well, welcome and thanks for joining me today on the lounge. I'm Nick May, your host, and today we're going to be talking about growing your interior design business. So whether you're in Chicago, Milan, or Burlington, North Carolina, I know you want to do one thing. You want to grow your interior design business. And we're going to do just that by finding out how successful designers do that from around the world. Well, guys, you have heard me talking about this. We are launching into our guest host series, and I'm going to just give the reins right over to Stacy Garcia.
Welcome, and thanks for joining me today in the lounge. I'm Stacy Garcia, your host, recording from my design studio in New York. For those of you who aren't familiar with me, I'm the founder of Stacy Garcia, Inc., a design house with roots in the hospitality industry. I've built my brand through licensing with 23 active partnerships and product all over the world. And I've most recently made the leap into the retail world with a line for QVC. As an entrepreneur myself, design and business are so close to my heart. Have you ever wondered about starting your own business? What it takes to stay relevant in today's market? Well, that's exactly what we're going to dive into on my episodes featuring captivating conversation with inspiring designers in the industry. So sit back, relax, and join me while we have a chat with our guest, Clota. Today, I am honored to be interviewing the one named icon in the design industry, Miss Clota. She started out born in Ireland to an aristocratic family that she says was downwardly mobile and didn't let that stop her from being incredibly successful. I was so interested to learn about how she got her start first in the fashion world and then parlayed that into an incredible career in design, in art, in writing, and now in philanthropy. She is cross-cultural, cross-generational, and has so much wisdom to share with us. Let's get started listening to Clota. So Clota, we are so excited to have you with us today on the Chaise Lounge. And just take us back to the beginning, because I'm so curious to know, you know, when did you first realize that you wanted to be in the creative fields?
Well, I think I was always in the creative field in a sense, because I lived in the west of Ireland, actually, in Oscar Wilde's country home, and then we moved quite a few times. And I had horses and dogs, and I fell off one of those horses and broke my back.
Oh, boy. How old were you when that happened?
I was 15.
Oh, wow.
Going on 16. I was on my back nearly a year. And my father had planned for me to do classics and mathematics in Trinity College because his brother had taught there, was teaching there. And I was lying on my back in pain, and my mother brought me in the Irish Times, and I held it over my head because I wasn't allowed to sit up. And I saw an ad, why not be a dress designer? And I thought, well, why the heck not?
I love that.
It's kind of bitter my motto ever since.
Yes.
I come from a family with an awful lot of names, and I'm very minimalist, so I dropped the names and kept my own name, like my Christian name, Clota.
Yes.
And when I was able to get out and about, I just finished my school year and did 6 weeks training in the Grafton Academy of Dress Design, the people that actually put the ad in the paper, decided to open my own business when I was 17.
Wow.
With the courage brought on, the kind of courage you get when you're totally ignorant.
Yes.
I mean, you have no idea how ignorant I was. I remember my mother gave me some money and my father locked me out because I wasn't doing what he wanted me to do.
Right.
So I opened a bank account, I rented a little studio and started my business. I hired the best tailor I could find and the best seamstress I could find. And that started off two things. One was that to always hire people who are better than yourself, always hire people who know more than you do. And it also started out a true knowledge on my total ignorance, because when my bank manager called and asked me if I would bring down my books to him. I brought him down the books I was reading, and I said, "Why do you want to? Why do you want to see the books I'm reading, Mr. Mooney?"
Right. It's great. I know. I mean, it, and it's so typical, right? You're like, you just don't know what you don't know.
No, I know, and it's one of the reasons I'm so involved with education, because people should be taught stuff like that, you know, at school, you know, life skills.
Amen. I agree.
The fact I came practically, I think I came first in Ireland, certainly in classic and mathematics, but I had no life skills.
Sure, right. You didn't know how to reconcile a bank statement, I'm sure.
So I started my fashion business, and I was very lucky because the Irish Cancer Society had read a little thing about my coming out from my design school. And they had published some of the work that I had prepared in design school. And they invited me to do a fashion show at the very smart Hibernian Hotel to raise money for the Irish Cancer Society.
Oh, wow.
That was my kickstart, really.
So I'm still amazed. You know, here you are, 17 years old. You read the article or the advertisement in the paper, and you said, like, why the hell not? Okay, I'll go study dress design. And without having interned anywhere or apprenticed, you decided you were just going to start your own fashion house, so to speak. I mean, that's brave.
I think I've got the kind of personality that's a little unemployable.
Right. No, do it my way. Uh-huh.
I always gallop my horse very fast, to be upfront.
I love that. Yes. So, and how much money did you start this business with? What did your mother loan you?
£400, which had been about $600, I think, in those days.
Wow. And how did you know what to do first?
Well, what I did was I hung out my little sign saying Clos de Haute Couture, of course, nothing less. And I had these two brilliant people I had found to work with me, you know. And somebody saw the sign and walked upstairs. And that was my first, actually, reject, because she looked at me when I opened the door and she said, "I want to meet the designer." And I said, "I am the designer." And she said, "You look very young. How old are you?"
Yeah.
And I said, "I'm 17. And she said, "Too young, not enough experience. I'll come back when you have more experience."
Right.
So she went away, but she did come back a year and a half later.
Amazing. People want to see that you're sort of proving your concept, right? That you haven't folded.
Yeah. Yes, exactly, exactly.
So do you remember your first client?
I do. She was an older woman, and she was a very interesting woman. She lived just outside of Dublin, and I made a lot of clothes for her, probably in her late 70s, actually.
And how did she find you? Similar?
Again, the same thing.
The same.
Yeah, because the fashion show brought me a lot of publicity, and then it kind of rolled on from there. The Irish Business Development Group became interested in me, and Tweed companies and so on. And they asked me to advise them and consult with them. And the BBC got very interested in me and did two movies. Actually, they were doing a show called Inside Ireland, and they took me as the fashion maker. And that all added up to Montgomery Ward calling me. Representative Montgomery Ward, the American catalog, calling me and asking me if I'd be interested in consulting with them on design. So all this is happening. Meanwhile, I get married. I have three boys, and it was quite a juggling act get it all together.
I have a 17-year-old now. I cannot imagine him starting a business. You know.
No.
So it's it's impressive.
But anyway, I aligned myself with production people, and soon I had quite a decent-sized business. I was working, designing for other companies, like a German suit factory that had a factory in Ireland, and Irish knits and stuff like that. And I exported in the end all over the world, you know. I export to Australia, you know, Canada, Lord & Taylor, Bergdorf's, you know, all those names.
Amazing. And then, so take me to that. I mean, the podcast is really also about not just design, but the business of design. So when you're in the fashion design world and you're this young woman building a brand, you know, some people call it lucky breaks. I like to say, you know, look, you don't get, this was literally a lucky break for you, right? I mean, you fell off your horse and this really, yeah. the trajectory of your horse. Yeah. So truly there, it's a literal one, but you know, you put yourself out in order to be discovered. People don't just come knocking on your door, right? You have to take that leap of faith. But now you're starting to get the attention and you're getting these great gigs, these great opportunities. How did you sort of figure out, you know, like you said, how to get into the production piece or how to get into the export? Was it more good hires? Was it through your first hires? How did you decide who the next people were to bring on board?
Well, what happened was I expanded within my studio and we started to make a fashion for some very well-known people, you know, kind of wives of rock stars and stuff like that. And as I said, the publicity kept growing. And then at the Irish Export Development Group approached me and said they would sponsor me to go with other Irish designers to the States to show during Fashion Week. So I was showing my collection in a suite at the Plaza, and that's where I got my first big orders.
Oh, wow.
And then you can, if you get an order from a company that's a buying group that's registered, and, you know, you can do what's called discounting your order, and the bank will give you the money to make the order.
Right.
And get it out. So I had to do that, which was, you know, again, you pay the bank something. It's like getting a mortgage or something.
Right.
And, you know, I had a huge order from Lord & Taylor for, you know, this opened for, it was like an Irish Fashion Week there. And then the publicity kept growing. And, of course, I was on TV over here in the States.
Right.
And the business kept growing. But it wasn't easy. I mean, I think it's a good idea to have some money in the bank when you start. I'm very hand-to-mouth.
Of course, yeah. I mean, you do what you have to do, right?
Yeah, and I drove all over the country to find weavers and knitters, people like that, who would really support my brand.
Right.
And all I wanted to do was to make people happy in their clothes. The wife of the president of Ireland actually came to me. She was going to Africa. And she said, this is so difficult, you know, because you're going to be in temperatures that are over 100 degrees and humidity and so on and so forth. And I figured out a wardrobe that would make her feel comfortable and happy at special events. Because I'm all about wellness. And of course, having broken my back and been to a lot of different kinds of healers, I became interested in wellness very early on. And fashion and ease of self became, for me, the word for wellness. If you're wearing clothes that you feel good in, they move with your body, you can travel easily, and making life easier.
Yes, I agree with that ethos, especially for travel. So at that point in time, was the aesthetic clear? Was it sort of very, you know, similar to where you are today, or was it different at the time?
My fashion aesthetic was very much the way I am now in design. I don't do just interior design. I consult on landscapes, do all sorts of things. I do branding and help people to develop their brand.
Yes. So at what point do you parlay from fashion into interior design and architecture?
Well, the career was going well. Three boys were lovely, and the marriage wasn't going well. So I changed husbands, countries, and careers and moved to Spain.
Okay, good. That's one way to take care of it.
I've spent my life making pretty radical moves, and that was a pretty radical move. I didn't even speak Spanish, so...
These are probably words of wisdom beyond, you know, I think we should sort of pause on it, because how many of us or the listeners out there, you feel stuck in your situation, right? You're unhappy, but you're saying, but I have three children, or I'm unhappy, but I have this business I've invested in, or there's always a reason, some kind of anchor, I call it, that you feel is anchoring you to your situation. And, you know, did you sort of pain over that decision, or were you always built that you're not happy, then you, like you said, you gallop fast on your horse. You know, what did it take to make that leap?
I think I was primed by my childhood. I didn't have the easiest childhood. Lovely places to live, but my family was downwardly mobile financially because of a kind of family scandal that my parents had created. So their riches were cut away and we were lived very hand to mouth. And we moved five times before I was 16. I realized possessions weren't terribly important to me, that relationships were more important. So a lot of people are held down by what they have in storage, by what they own, by where they live, and sort of let those bonds tie them to relationships that they're not really feeling very good in.
Right. So it was, not to say easier, but like you said, that you didn't have that same weight of the physical and material that other people have.
Yes. And the other thing is that I like the feeling of things that last a long time. And just before I made the radical decision, I was in New York and I was giving my last fashion show. And in Ireland, giving my last fashion show, I did it all in black.
Right.
The bride.
And that clothes, was the swan clothes, song for clothes, the fashion.
And clothes, and clothes shop, yeah. Because fashion is wonderful, but it's ephemeral.
Yes.
And a lot of people feel that they have to follow trends and this, that, and the other. I hate the word trend. I want to create movements and follow movements, you know, to be leadership in movement, like I'm doing leadership in the wellness movement for the last 1,000 years, it seems, at this point.
I don't think that long, but yes, maybe your soul has been here a few times before. Yeah. So Spain took you to, it was a new country, new husband, and new career, right? So
well,
you left the
career,
fashion
The new bones. Career happened in an interesting way, because I had been employing quite a lot of people and, you know, had not a huge business, but a reasonably sized business. And I didn't speak Spanish, and I married a Frenchman.
Uh-huh.
And we bought a townhouse on an old square in Almeria, a town in the south of Spain. And we bought a farmhouse up in the hills, and both of them were a mess. So since I'm very loaded with energy, I said to Danielle, my husband, you know what, I'll take care of fixing up the townhouse and the farm, and you go on with your development and what you're doing. He actually changed careers at the same time from screenwriting to real estate.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And did he speak Spanish?
Yes, he's French, but he'd been brought up in Cuba and Mexico as well. Came to Spain when, to New York when he was 12.
Okay, so at least he was able to communicate in that new career. So you said, you go do your thing, and I got this. I'll oversee this.
Yeah, I said, I can learn Spanish while I'm doing this, because I'm going to have to, because nobody here speaks English, as if not Madrid or Barcelona, a small town.
Right.
So we had to hire an architect, and I started to work with the architect, and I realized he knew nothing about living. All he could think about was architecture. And this house was a, you know, grand old house with 40-foot high shutters looking out over the old square, wonderfully positioned.
Right.
And I kept drawing over his drawings and saying, Antonio, this is not the way people live. No, the kitchen is not like 5 miles away from the dining room. They should be side by side.
Yeah.
And the day that it had been used by a law office, and it was full of tiny little partitions. And the day demolition happened, the shutters were open.
Uh-huh.
The sun was shining in, and it caught the dust and made this huge mote of light. And it was almost biblical. It hit my left shoulder, and I realized what I wanted to do.
Wow.
And there was a ground floor retail area. And when my husband came home, I said, Danielle, I've decided what I want to do. So it was that fast. I said, I want to take the downstairs office and do an architectural design company, because these guys don't know what they're doing. I have to.
Right. I have to go save the people over here.
Exactly. Exactly. Again, I hung out my sign.
Right.
And went upstairs. I was no sooner upstairs, but the doorbell rang. And I knew nothing about architecture and design except of what I'd been working on in my own house in Ireland. I went down, opened the door. There was a guy, really cute guy, standing outside. And he said, are you the English designer? And I said, no, I'm the Irish designer.
Right.
And he said, well, that's close enough. I'm opening an English bar. Would you design it for me?
I love that. Was this truly the same day or, you know, very quick?
As soon as my sign was out, the same day.
That's unbelievable.
And then I went upstairs and I said to my husband, you know, I'm an absolute idiot. I've told this guy I'll do it, you know. And he said, you can do it. You can do anything.
Yeah.
So
I love that.
Drove down, And I got the job, and then the architect liked what I was doing, and he hired me to do his own house, and the rest was history in Spain, you know.
Now, did you have to get licensed as an architect or no?
No, I don't have a license in anything. I'm totally untrained, really. Again, I hired the best people I could find. I found an architect from Liverpool who was doing environmental houses, you know, working with the sun pattern and the wind pattern, solar energy. Away we went, you know.
Hey guys, Nick here. Just wanted to break in really quick and remind you that we couldn't do this if it wasn't for our sponsors. And I just had the opportunity to spend some time with my friends at Porcelainosa at their New York Park Avenue showroom. And when I was interviewing designers that hadn't been into the showroom before, one of the things that I've noticed when I get to interview designers in the Porcelainosa showroom is that they always tell me, oh my gosh, I had no idea, Nick, they had so many different products. Most people think of them just as tile, or porcelain tile to be specific. But if you go to their showroom or you go to their website, you'll notice they have cabinets, they have faucets and fixtures and toilets and shower enclosures and natural wood, natural stone. They have a really great LVT product. So if you're not super familiar with Porcelainosa, or even if you think you're familiar with Porcelainosa, please go stop by one of their showrooms and check out all the amazing products that they have. It's not just tile.
How did you know what to charge as a fee when you're starting out with your first client?
That was difficult, actually. I figured out what the architect was charging, and I felt I was at least worth that, so I charged what he was charging hourly, and I got it.
Okay. And then did you have to put a scope around, this is how many hours I think this project will take, or the client was sort of willing to trust you on it?
Well, he gave me a budget. And
okay.
Said, you go over it. It's happened to me a couple of times. It happened to me in New York, too. The client said to me, this is the budget. This is what I have to spend. If you spend any more than that, it'll come out of your own fee.
Right.
So he was tough on the budget. And
okay.
I've always worked with artisans and artists. I found a wonderful gypsy who did shell work, you know, shell collages. It sounded very folksy, but it wasn't. It was really beautiful, quite dramatic.
Uh-huh.
So I had him do my back bar for me and stuff like that, and it was very successful.
Wow. And then that was a launching pad for Clota Design and Architecture.
Yeah.
And how long were you in Spain then?
I was in Spain 7 years, and then my husband decided to come to New York. His parents were aging, and he wanted to be with them. So I came too, reluctantly, but I came too. Of course, I'd been in New York, but in the fashion business.
Right.
Now I was in a different business. And again, the remarkable coincidence in my life, I was walking down Madison Avenue thinking, you know, I'd never even taken a photograph of my work in Spain. It's quite funny because I really did some quite nice stuff.
Yeah.
I was walking down Madison Avenue thinking about life and thinking, you know, what the heck am I going to do? How am I going to start up? And I ran into a guy who had actually photographed my fashion house for a poster called The Doors of Dublin, the beautiful Georgian door. He said, Clota, what are you doing here? I thought you were in Spain. I said, I know. I said, I've moved here. He was in advertising, and he had photographed The Doors of Dublin, and he dined in my home and stuff like that in Ireland. How's that for triangulation?
Amazing.
And he said, what are you doing now? And I said, well, actually, I'm started to do a design for homes and restaurants and stuff like that. And he said, would you do my office for me?
That's
and
incredible.
I said, hang on, you've never seen my work. He said, I was in your house. That's enough.
Right.
So I did his home and his office, and I was off and running again.
That's amazing. I love that. And I call that the higher power moments, you know. There's no coincidence.
Yeah, it was kind of magic. Yeah, it was kind of magic, I must say.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's sort of how your life has gone, right? I mean, you sort of take that step over the threshold and say, I'm doing this, I'm hanging my shingle, there it is.
Well, I think it's all a question of positive energy, you know, of wanting something to happen and being open for it to happen.
Yes. Yes, and then being willing to do just that is to say, why not?
Yeah.
Right?
I got my biggest first job in New York in the Solo building in 9 West 57th, you know, the big nine. Yes. One building with a big red 9 in front of it. Because I was actually in a bar. I was helping a friend of mine from Ireland who was starting a nightclub and bar. And I was there at a party and with a group. And I went up to the bar to get a drink for somebody. And I heard an Irish accent next to me. And I turned to the guy and I said, "What's a nice Irish boy like you doing in a dive like this?"
Right.
It's the kind of way we speak in Ireland.
Right.
And he said, "Well, I'm opening offices in 9 West 57th for my business." And I said, "Well, here you have an Irish designer ready to work with you. Are you going to hire me?"
I love it.
He said, "Well, do you want to call me tomorrow?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. Give me your number." I called him and I got it.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
And you have to believe in yourself enough to even have the, what we call chutzpah, to do the ask, the gumption.
Yeah, well, if you know you're going to do your very best for people and you're authentic and you need to fulfill a proper job that makes people feel well and happy to work there and that helps them to achieve their higher self and their highest ambitions by being supported by the space, if you really believe in that, and I do, it makes me very positive about looking for new business.
Sure. Well, it's almost a disservice to not make the offer when it comes from a high place like that. So your aesthetic is, it's as unique as your name. Like you said, you've been a leader in the wellness movement for many years, less than 1,000, but many years. And it's just an incredibly honed, beautiful aesthetic that, like you said, it is a calming space. They are timeless spaces. You feel good in them. Was that always your aesthetic, or is that something that you honed? You know, when did you first get turned on to the idea of this? And I know feng shui is part of your practice as well. So did that all go hand in hand? Was there an epiphany moment? Talk to me about that.
Well, because I'd moved so many times and I was laden down by the kind of aristocratic family who had stuff, you know, antiques and stuff like that. And as the houses got smaller and smaller, the antiques were sent out to be sold to send the 3 kids, my family, to boarding schools.
Yeah.
I realized that I didn't even like the stuff and that, you know, we kids were forced to clean the silver and, you know.
Right.
So we were nannying the house rather than the house nannying us. So when I had my first apartment on my own, you know, when I started my first business, I realized I didn't want very much stuff in it at all. And that all I needed was a really good bed, a really good sofa, you know.
And yes.
And a space to think and a place for everything and everything in its place. So that's kind of carried through. Does that answer your question?
Yes, yes. I wasn't sure if it was, you know, like you said, on a trip to Africa or on a trip to Asia, you know, something like that. But yes, that does answer it. And that makes so much sense when you are weighed down by the stuff and you do realize, like you said, not only, you know, is it not important, but I don't even like it. And that was the catalyst for your aesthetic and really for this movement. So we talked a lot about your success in business and how these opportunities have seemed to find you and, you know, the positive energy you've put into the world. But the roads are not always smooth. Can you tell us about any bumps in the road? Was there a failure? And what did you learn from that?
Well, I don't believe there's such a thing as failure. I think you just go off on a side road.
Uh-huh.
And I never had anybody financing me, so I always was self-financing, you know. It was hard to get a bank loan and stuff in the beginning. But things like a 911, for instance, was major impact on my business because most of my business at that time was actually down in that area.
Wow.
So we had to, you know, there was a bit of hard scrabble, but, you know, we got through it. 2008, the downturn,
yes. Or
you're working for a big hotel and suddenly the money falls through, the person who's financing it drops out or something. There's always ups and downs. Even somebody dies, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so you're resilient.
You just have to draw in your horns and just, I always called it surfing, you know.
Yes.
Get in your surfboard and surf it, knowing that it will turn around, and it does.
Yes, you have to just stand there, keep your balance long enough.
Yeah, and as you get a reputation and cash flow, then the banks come in to help you too.
Right. And I think that's important also. You know, there's young designers too. As you said, we don't learn some of these life skills in school. You certainly don't learn the finance piece in design school either. So I think it is important.
And one should, when I'm speaking at a design college and stuff like that, I always say that people, by the time they leave school, you should be able to manage a budget, cook well, certainly adequately, and live and manage your own health. You know, people are sent out of school with all kinds of skills they can't use.
Right, for sure.
You know, I'm a great believer in neuroplasticity, and schooling, of course, helps, you know, and helps the brain to expand and grow and stuff like that. But in the radical living, day-to-day living that we have to put through, we really need to learn a lot of basic skills, living skills.
Yes. And again, if you don't know, then you need to ask and learn. And like you said, you sit with your bankers or you sit with a SCORE counselor if you're a small business owner or look for a mentor. So did you have mentors in your career?
When I was in Spain, my husband was basically my mentor. He guided me, you know, in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But when I came to the States and I did my first job at 9 West 57th, the big one, Jack Lenner Larson was a tremendous mentor for me.
Oh, wonderful.
Larson Fabrics and everything. He's a wonderful man.
Sure. And were you specifying his product? How did you get in touch with him?
I actually covered the walls of the CEO's office, the wonderful Sean Silk, in a very neutral color. And the guy from Jack's showroom, who had sold it to me, said, "How did it go?" I said, "Well, come on over and have a look." And he went wild with excitement. I said, "Jack, you'd better go and look." So Jack came and looked and loved it. And I was off and running, you know?
Yes. And so hit it off at that point with him.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that.
But it's all about people. I had a teacher once who said, if you don't feel happy after you've left somebody, just for being with them for a second, even if it's just a brief meeting, you really have to examine what's going on. Are you making them unhappy? Are they making you unhappy? How do you edit your life to keep supportive people in it? And I think the answer is you have to have your outgoing energy flow extremely high, you know, so people know that you're here for them and that you will help them.
Yes.
Particularly with clients, you know, very hard to be a client. You're not a designer, you're a client, right?
Right.
Most of them aren't designers. It's a nerve-wracking thing to be spending a lot of money and wonder if you're going to be happy in what you get.
Right. Well, you have a clear aesthetic. Have you ever had that where you had a client who hired you and then didn't really want the Clota aesthetic? Like they thought they wanted it, but that's not what they wanted.
Well, saying I have clear aesthetic isn't quite correct. It's a point of view and a way of life, which is not an aesthetic. Designers are chameleons in a sense and have to be.
Yes.
I mean, I designed a disco, restaurants, you name it, you know, that I wouldn't want to live in. But you're basically realizing that everybody you work with has a brand, whether it is a brand or whether it's a human being simply wanting a residential place. And you have to, as a designer, examine their brand and see what's going to make them happy. And then you apply your design ideas to that. A designer is a travel guide. And you know the way a good guide brings you to places that you wouldn't have gone to before.
Right.
But they've already, the travel guide has taken you to the normal places.
Right. So then you get to go see the off the beaten path ones.
Yes, it brings them a few steps further. They're always happy with that. And also, I think it's observing how people respond to colors and light and so on. We also get their horoscope sign. It's very important.
Yes,
for
I
us.
Saw that.
Yeah. So when the suits come into our office, sometimes we ask for their horoscope sign. They're a little bit taken aback, and then they smile. we hug in our office because we like human contact.
Yes. I love that. I do love that. So talk to me about some of the other things you design. I know you said, okay, nightclubs, and you have a wide repertoire on the interior and architecture piece, but you also design furniture and fabric and all kinds of products. Now, that's set up through licensing, or are you manufacturing that?
Uh-huh. No, we don't manufacture anything. One of our companies is called Clota Collection, which consists of me buying stuff furniture or art objects or stuff like that, and also bespoke furniture that we're designing specially for just one person or two people, what have you. So that's Clota Collection. And we have Clota Signature, which is licensing, where we actually design collections for people, and they, the people we design for are the distributors. And it's a bit like having a child and sending it to college, and the child does well and sends you back checks. So in the beginning, you have to invest some development money, although very often you get a little money in advance from the licensee. But it's very nice. So I've got stuff out there that I designed 25 years ago that's still sending, bringing in checks.
That's great.
I was going to say, there's another mentor of mine, but he didn't know it, is Terence Conran.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I am. Didn't he used to have the shop under the bridge, or am I confusing him with somebody?
Yes. The thing is that it's nice to make things democratic and available for everybody.
Yes.
Wellness should be available for everybody, and simply design things at work should be available for everybody. And he is quite wonderful. He really started me off on that kind of thinking. I used to buy his dinnerware and stuff like that when I was in Dublin. I used to fly to London and pick it up.
Okay, so then he mentored you. You had a relationship with him as well.
I didn't have a relationship with him. I had a relationship with what he did. You know, I met him, but he was, you know, there's a lot of people I admire, you know, a lot of architects I admire that really feed my aesthetic, you know?
Yes.
But I don't necessarily know them personally.
I love that advice, because I think so many of us also, you know, you get caught up in, I have to speak to them or have this relationship. And of course, a true mentor mentee, you know, you do have that access, but that you can be inspired by the way that somebody else is approaching design, or inspired by the way someone else is approaching their business, or what their ethos is, or what their mantra is. And that can catapult you into new ideas for your own business.
I have a quote wall in my studio, a wall of quotes from just people who inspire me, you know?
Yes. What's one of your favorites? Let's hear it.
Well, he's not on the wall, but Oscar Wilde is a wonderful quote. He talks about the person who knows about the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Yes.
And then Saint-Exupéry, who wrote The Little Prince.
Yes.
He was also a designer, and he said, a design is not complete when you've added everything you can add. A design is complete when you've taken away everything you can take away.
Mm.
You know, that's, I love the Dalai Lama. Approach love and cooking with reckless abandon.
Yes. The cooking, I'm still trying to make the attempt, Clota.
Yeah, I'm working on a personal memoir and cookbook, which also has cooking in it.
Oh, wonderful.
Recipes in it, yeah.
I love that. That's what I was going to ask. What's next for you? So that's next on the docket, huh?
Oh, there's lots on it. I started an art consulting company in January, because I realized I'd been consulting on art for my clients all my life. I've started a formal art consulting company.
And you've done that, you've set that up as a separate entity, a separate LLC?
As a separate entity, yes.
And then you're working with other designers, or you're consulting for patrons?
That's the idea, working with other architects or designers, exactly. I have artists, as I've collected their contacts, and I've seen their work and so on through the years. You know, the work that heals, you know, work for wellness.
Yes.
Work that brings you joy when you look at it. You know, the Francis Bacons of this world are wonderful painters, but I'd prefer to see them in a museum, not in my bedroom.
And how is that structured? Are you acting as an agent to these artists, or?
I'm not working as an agent. I sometimes buy and resell, depending. I had my own first art exhibition. I don't know if you know that, earlier this year.
Okay.
I had a one-man show, one-woman show in Tribeca.
Oh, fabulous.
But part of what's next is expanding my photography. But also, I'd like to work with emerging artists, not just for price, but also that while they're still alive, they can eat and drink and feed their children and pay their rent. Because one of the things that struck me as a disaster was when I went to the Van Gogh exhibition at the Met, and the posters outside were selling for more than I think he probably made in his entire life.
Right.
No. So it's not just wellness for clients, it's wellness for the people we involve, you know, financial wellness.
And I think, you know, you have a history of being philanthropic, a history of giving back. And like you said, it's part of the whole idea of that, the wellness movement, but that for your soul, for your spirit to be well, you have to feel that you're contributing at a deep level.
Absolutely.
And I know you're also on the board still of the Thorn Tree Project.
Yes, I'm the co-founder of it with Jane Newman. And we're in our 19th year now, I think. We started out with 131 kids, and now we've over 1,500 kids, and we have 18 years later, we have college graduates for a tribe of pastoral nomads, and most of the parents were totally illiterate, and particularly the women. So we did the first girls, we helped to raise the money for the first girls' dorm, we raised money for water. It's been, you know, we do a lot of philanthropic work because I think you just have to keep giving back. We're all extraordinarily lucky, you know.
Yes.
My clients and vendors are immensely supportive, you know. It's great.
How did you first get turned on to this need from the Thorn Tree Project? You know, what was the catalyst? Were you traveling?
I've always been involved with philanthropy in one way or another because my mother was, even though she didn't have any money, she always gave of herself. She always helped other people. And then when I went to boarding school, they gave us a choice as who we would like to support philanthropically. And I chose an old lady to go to read to her because she was lonely. And then when I left school, I got involved in other stuff. Jane Newman, the founder, was actually traveling the North-South African Highway when the jeep she was driving with two friends broke down in the Samburu Desert region. And night was falling. It's a fairly dangerous area. And these women and children warriors came out of the bush. And they were a little scared. I mean, you know, Jane and the friends were a little scared. But one of the warriors leaned over the jeep and said, in English, can we help you? And they walked the guys to the place where they could find the part. And the chief took Jane in for the night in his cinder block house in the village. They don't really have villages. They have compounds because they're pastoral. So they move, you know, mm-hmm. they move with the grazing. And she said they were so generous that when she was leaving, she said to Chief George, the chief, she said, you've been so nice to me. How can I help you? And he said, help us to educate our children because the world the way it is now, the tribe will not survive unless we're educated. Mm-hmm. So Jane and I have been friends for quite some years. She was the head of Chiat Day at one point. She was very high in the advertising business. She walked into my studio when she got back from Africa, and she said, got a project, little school project in Africa, and she's English. Can you help me? And I can't say no to a friend. So I said, of course. Well, here I am.
Right. How wonderful and how rewarding, like you said, to have some of them be college graduates at this point. It's incredible.
No, and we have nurses, we've got electricians, we've got plumbers. I mean, there's no plumbing up there, but it's fantastic. Yeah, it makes me very happy.
Yes.
And you know, everybody around me is so supportive to, you know, help us to keep it alive, you know, to raise funds.
Yes, how wonderful. So where can we learn more about some of the things you're working on?
The philanthropy or?
Oh, any of it. Yeah, tell us about the philanthropy stuff and tell us about your new ventures in the art world. Where can we find you?
You can find me on my website. On the website, the art is already in most of our projects. The art has been selected by me. And then our art consultancy project is going to go up on the website soon. We've been very busy with it, so I couldn't even take the time to make the web appearance. And, you know, there's great stuff coming. We've got a fantastic multifamily building in Washington that's going to open late next year, early the following year. And it's all about wellness and joy. We have one fantastic project that's published in Interior Design at the moment.
Uh-huh.
It's 1,875 apartments in three towers in Long Island City.
Oh, wow.
Where the Fishman's Fire decided that they would build a wellness building for all the tenants so they could go and either play basketball or chess or go to the spa or go to swim. No, it's a really big leap in the development business. to have yes. that much amenities.
That's definitely, like, I know you don't trends, but that's definitely a new trend, and I think that's for the better.
What's not very nice is competitive, so the developers are competing against each other now to offer more amenities and more wellness. And I, as I say, I don't like trends, but I do like competition.
Yes.
I once said to somebody, I'm not competitive, I just like to win.
That's how it's done. I think that is a great place to end. And so again, for more information, people can visit clota.com and they can find, like you said, your projects, your products, and information about the philanthropy that you are so involved in.
And they can look for, at my books too. My new book, Life Enhancing Design, actually tells a lot of the story. It's a more personal design book than the other ones I've written.
Okay, good. And that's out already?
Oh, yes. Came out last year.
Life Enhancing actually. Design. And yeah. So the new one, the next one coming up, does that have a name yet?
No. Okay. And it's very, very under wraps at the moment.
Okay. So we'll have to, you know, put that under lock and key and keep it in the vault until you are ready to launch.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Clota, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I have learned so much and appreciate the wisdom that you shared.
And thank you, because, you know, just talking about what I'm doing gives me more courage to do more of what I'm doing.
Yes.
Thank you.
We can't wait to see it. Really, truly, it was an honor. Thank you, Clota.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm Stacey Garcia. I've been your host of this episode of The Chaise Lounge, and I hope you enjoyed my interview with interior designer, architect, author, artist, philanthropist, Clota. If you like my show and you want to know more about my brand, you can check out stacygarcia.com or follow me at Stacey Garcia Inc. on social media. And join me for my next episode when we chat with another iconic design visionary. And remember, stay inspired.